and welcome to the big interview here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound. My guest today is a restaurateur, the co-proprietor of many of London's best-loved restaurants. In fact, if you take all his past and current kitchens, maybe all of London's favourite dining rooms. Jeremy King was born in Somerset, southwest England, and went off to work in London in the early 1970s. He almost became a banker, but an actual roll of a die changed his mind to stay on at a wine bar in Chelsea, the seed that became several mighty oaks. Le Caprice, the Ivy, Jay Sheiky, all with business partner Chris Corbin. Having sold those three restaurants, Corbin and King was founded to focus on creating incredible rooms in which to eat. The Wolseley, the Delaunay, Brasserie Zadel, the Beaumont Hotel, amongst others, that soon became famous for grandeur rather than hauteur, an accessible idea of excellence, and seeming like a classy, ready-made party in which to imagine oneself front and centre. Is Jeremy King a frustrated novelist? He comes up with intricate plots and moving foundation myths for his creations, restaurants as windows on the soul, depending upon how much Riesling you've drunk. Jeremy King and Chris Corbin have changed the easiness and enjoyment with which Londoners eat out. A fact celebrated in a new book about Brasserie Zadel called Traditions and Recipes from a Grand Brasserie by A.A. Gill. So what's the secret and how many tables does he hold back just in case Elvis really is alive and in the building? Jeremy, thank you so much for coming into the studio today. And we hope that the surroundings meet your approval as well. Some people come in here fresh from the BBC and say, God, these are really nice, these studios. Yeah. It's got a very studio feel.
It's not at all intimidating.
So we've turned up the heat a little bit and we've tried to give it a bit of a vibe. As an expert on rooms, we could talk about a million things. We could kick it off in a million ways, Jeremy. I wanted to ask you actually about the last restaurant you opened, Bellinger, in Islington, on the Green there. And I wanted to get into the backstory, because I know that you have almost a novelistic approach to coming up with the people that might have dined in the restaurant 100 years previously, the Dowager Duchesses feeding their chihuahuas at the table, etc. Maybe Dowager Duchesses don't have chihuahuas. But I know that you come up with a huge Stanislavskian backdrop to your restaurants. Talk us through the idea of yours and Chris Corbin for Bellinger.
It's interesting because in some ways Bellinger defies that backstory side, and the reason being is because we've always been creating places in the Grand Café tradition.
Yeah.
And the restaurants divide effectively into two, what we call the locals, which you'd imagine Bellinger to be, and the grand restaurants. Wolsey, Delaunay, and now actually Bellinger don't have the backstory that the likes of Colbert and Fisher's do. But the generation of a backstory module is that I feel that whether it's hotels or restaurants, we're getting into a world where everything's homogenized. People copy. Everybody's informed by what everybody else does. And you might look at the way we do restaurants and say, well, you seem firmly entrenched in the early part of the 20th century, but for me, that's purely reacting to buildings, and that's the way we work. It all started off really with Beaumont, because back in 2011, I was lying in bed 4 a.m. in the morning, having to, the next day, brief a design architect's team as to what the hotel should be.
And this, by the way, is, in brackets, is your first
our first hotel. And I had no end of ideas of how the hotel should work and the sort of things which annoy me about hotels. I go to lots of gratuitous questions, how was your journey, all the sort of things you don't want to talk about. And rooms which didn't really work and practical, an obsession with having two sinks in a bathroom when there's no room to put anything around them. And I was quite happy to defy all the normal principles within a luxury hotel idiom. But what was it going to be? And I remember talking to Chris and saying, have you had any thoughts? And he said, nope, you're on your own.
That's what business partners are fraternal.
But absolutely. And so I was lying Sunday morning, 4 a.m., thinking, what am I going to do? And bemoaning the fact that there was no history to build on. And because I think hotels are beginning to look all the same, whether you can walk into a hotel in any number of countries and be forgiven for not knowing where the hell you are when you wake up in the morning. And I think places need to have an identity and not just steal from each other. So as I lay there, slightly starting to panic, as much as I ever panic, I thought, it's so much easier with a story. Well, maybe I should invent a story. Now, the Beaumont was built as a car park in 1926. Yeah. So I immediately, as an amateur historian, I start thinking, what's happening 26? What's happening 26? And I look at Britain, and it was a pretty depressed time then, and nothing much of note happening. But New York was exciting because they had prohibition. Of course, instead of curbing the amount people drank it, I think it increased fourfold. And suddenly the story came to mind of a hotelier telling his best customers, he's a general manager, that he was going to leave the business because there was nothing in it, violence in New York and so on. And they persuaded him to open in London. And out of that came the story of Jimmy Beaumont. And it became a whole sequential tale that I started to live vicariously through Jimmy Beaumont, this imaginary character. And the history was written. I got up that moment, wrote the history, presented it the next morning, a history about what happened, how he retired in the 50s, Hemingway and Fitzgerald there during the war, the American embassy using it as a part of the enclave, and so on, until the CIA used it as a hostel, all in my imagination.
See, this stuff is amazing. People love this. Do you think when people eat in the restaurant there or stay at the hotel, if they pick up on one line of what you've just said, that it's a success? You are hiring staff as Jimmy Beaumont. You're hiring cooks and maitre d's and sommeliers as Jimmy Beaumont. Everyone that plumps the pillows before you, you know, turn down services, they can only work for Jimmy Beaumont. Does it make it easier a hotelier and a restaurateur when you're living vicariously through character?
I think it's fair comment. And I think as long as people understand the history there, and of course it's not a museum, and any of these places, we're going back to the 20s, 30s, 40s. Colbert is another example, but allowing them to develop. So it's that sense of tradition, sense of carrying on, which is sadly being lost. You know, when I look at New York and to see that the Four Seasons is going to be changed, I think is tragic, and we lose a lot of the restaurants. Now, mine happened to be new, but I think people like to feel they belong, not to be on a stage set created by a designer. I think I knew that we were getting somewhere when we were actually doing the presidential suite and the decking outside. And we sat in a meeting, and it was one of those normal things with design meetings that if you do committees, it just doesn't work. Mm. I always say a camel is a horse designed by a committee, and it sort of works.
That's
but
just
it's
the
not
kind
like
of thing
it.
Jimmy would say.
Yeah, Jimmy might say. But and so suddenly the architect said, well, we should have stone. And then the interior designer say, I like decking. And then the engineer said, well, it'd be better if we use this. And so it went on. And then suddenly somebody said, what would Jimmy have done in 26? And then I knew that we had somewhere. And although Jimmy...
That's why you've got a driving range there instead.
True. But Jimmy is now retreated, but he permeates the place. There are all the photographs, all the paintings could have been bought by him. And there's any number of stories about him collecting and being also, as restaurateurs and hoteliers need to be, a catalyst for making what other people want of their restaurant and hotel. But there was a lovely moment. We were actually launching with Joe Malone the Joe Loves Beaumont Candle, because we'd worked together on another project trying to help her out. And she said, if ever you want a scent, please let me know. And I went to her and I said, we're ready for that. And she developed up this wonderful scent. We were doing blind smellings, I suppose you would call it. And I said, yeah, I can get the tobacco and the wood and the leather and all that sort of thing. It's very evocative. It's exactly right. And I said, there's a tiny touch of citrus. And she said, oh, I'm so glad you picked up on that. She said, yes, there is citrus there. It's to suggest that Jimmy has just walked through the lobby and it's a hint of his aftershave.
Nice.
But going back to your question, I don't want people to take it too literally. I want them to sense it. And the restaurants, the hotel should work, even if you never looked at a picture carefully or understood the history or any of those elements. And it comes down to design generally, is that I have a very, very strong ethos, and Chris and I have felt this over the years, that design should never shout for attention, but should withstand scrutiny. And I think that, for me, is a fundamental part of creating environments for people.
Well, it's fascinating stuff because I think people would be interested to know that some of the central tenets of what drives the business and how those restaurants look, but more importantly, how they feel. Mm. And I think your restaurants, people take it as read that the cooking is good, but you create rooms rather than avant-garde menus. Is that a fair comment? Is that what you sort of set out to do, to create these wonderful spaces to be in?
I think that is absolutely right. I mean, I mentioned the word earlier, catalyst. Well, for both Chris and I, we wanted to create restaurants that we would like to go to. It seems in some ways bleeding obvious, but if you start with that and then go on to say, and then I'm going to treat people the way I would like to be treated, if the restaurateur takes that as the basic tenet, that works.
No diner has been thrown out for ordering salt in one of your restaurants.
No, we're not precious at all. I can't bear walking into the sort of restaurant which is a temple and all you can hear is the clink, clink, clink of cutlery on crockery and people whispering, "How's yours? Would you like to try mine?" No, it's a catalyst.
A night full of unsuccessful Valentine dinners.
They are the worst. That's a whole other story. If we were to do a survey around this building, why people last went out for dinner to a proper restaurant, people would have gone with their partner, with their family, with their friends, a reunion, business, interview, seduction, divorce. I mean, people do all the difficult stuff in public spaces. Yeah. And the great restaurants allow all those things to happen. Nothing should dominate too much. The music shouldn't be loud. The food shouldn't be too good, i.e. hushed reverence or anything like that. Show me a restaurant with a fantastic view, I'll show you a boring restaurant because a third of the people are looking out the window and the other two thirds are rather hacked off that they didn't get the window table and the atmosphere is not there. And I'd like a restaurant where you walk through the door and you feel you're almost scooped up by the atmosphere or the maitre d'hotel. And as you go to the table, you see people, you're looking in one direction, there's a friend or there's a celebrity, there's somebody who shouldn't be with somebody, and you arrive at a table and everybody's not looking at their phone or taking photographs of each other. There's this sense that you get lifted by the experience. And halfway through of a meal which you hope's going to go on forever as opposed to being some sort of obligation, somebody stops, looks down at the food and said, "You know what? This really is rather good."
Yes, that's right.
That's what
it happens. It happens by accident.
Yeah.
Like any good party, you don't really realise until you look at your watch and you realise you've been dancing for 2 hours.
Yeah.
I'd like to go back to the beginning, Jeremy, because I know that you worked in banking before you worked in restaurants. This is going right back. What happened? What was there an apocryphal tale that happened one night in a restaurant where you think, this is how I want to make my name, my money, and spend a lot of long hours, let's face it?
In some ways, it came into my blood. I lived in a holiday town in Somerset and used to help out a friend's parents who ran a cafe. I think I was fascinated by that, but I was absolutely zero vocational about going into the restaurant business. My problem is I had no idea really what I wanted to do. I had left school. I hadn't studied diligently. I had a university place, but it didn't appeal. And I thought, in the absence of doing what I really want to do, which give me the choice, I'd probably want been an architect. I'd love to have performed or written or created in some way. But I never felt I was going to be brilliant at any of those things. Good, but that wasn't enough. And one thing I am good at is I'm very much a logical and arithmetic person. And I thought, stupidly in those days, that the route to happiness was getting money. So I thought I'll go into the city and earn masses of money because it'll suit my temperament. Nothing could be further from the truth. And I languished in the city for about coming up for 2 years, reapplied to go up to university to Cambridge, and I had 9 months off. And in the interim, in order to supplement my income, as I joined the bank in 1973 on £1,050 a year, I seem to remember. And I worked part-time in a wine bar, which was the new genre on just off the King's Road. And that was fun. It was escape. It was less straitjacketed. I took to it in many ways. But I also made a fatal mistake in many counts, which was I read a book called The Dice Man by Luke Reinhardt. And Luke Reinhardt had written this novel partially from experience about a man who determines his life by the throw of a die. And the way it would work is he'd write down the options, some of them difficult, some of them scary, some of them safe, throw the dice and follow that path. And I started to do it socially for fun, or even to decide whether I went to work, or if I went to work, what character I would be that day. Nobody noticed it, really. It was awful. And meanwhile, I was having waited to go up to university, I went into the wine bar to just earn some money and stay in London. And when matriculation came through, I threw very complicated options on whether I went up to university then, next year, not at all. And one double dice option was to stay in catering for the rest of my life if I got managership of the wine bar within a month of being 21. It was an incredible long shot, and it came up, and I stayed. And although there's many a time I've regretted it, of course, I've also enjoyed it. But I still don't know what I want to do.
What about now, where London is considered by many as to be, if not the, certainly a food capital of the world? You've been on that pretty much near the front of that roller coaster. I wonder what you think of that and what you think of the prospects of people listening to this and thinking, well, if Jeremy King could do it in the mid-70s, what about me? I feel I don't know what I want to do. I could do this. What do you think of the chances of it? Do you think it's... Do you have to have four restaurants to make a living even these days in central London? How does it work?
It's an interesting question, because there is about economy of scale. And I think a lot of people are aspiring to open restaurants now. It is a much, much, much better profession than ever before. I was talking to an induction of new staff this week, and their induction is the whole day, and it involves me being with them for an hour and a half. I said, in 1981, your induction would have been somebody throwing an apron at you and getting on with it. It's very, very short on skills, and so it's a brilliant business to go into. And of course, you know, I have 61% of my staff are from European Union. Well, technically 84, because I'd like to include the British in the European Union. But the very nervous about what was happening, my business would be catastrophic. We'd never have made the advances without the help of European citizens. I have 60 nationalities working in the business alone, and 1,000 people. And I do feel we're getting oversaturated in terms of restaurants. And one of the questions they were asking me on Monday at my induction is, what advice would you give to a budding restaurateur? And we like helping people do that. My attitude goes back to what I was saying about create something you believe in, not just what you think might work. Take the chef from here, a menu idea from there, a designer from there, and put it all together. That doesn't work. Because the most important ingredients for any restaurant, it's not the location, the concept, the building, the chef, or anything. It's two things for me, which is heart and soul. And these are difficult to define. But I think if we all look at it, some of my best restaurant experiences have been in very, very plain, simple rooms with simple wooden tables and chairs. And I have eaten, I don't know, the all-white truffle menu from greats like Alain Ducasse in Paris. It's brilliant, but it's, for me, it's not my homeland. And what I'm saying to them as young restaurateurs is just keep control. Don't look to the big multi-million restaurants. Look to somebody like Russell Norman, who effectively found a rundown shop, got his paintbrush out, rallied around his friends, made some money, kept control. So nobody had to tell him what to do. And if Chris and I could point finger at one significant matter, is that throughout the time we owned those three restaurants, we had 100% control and nobody could tell us what to do. That's where we developed our style.
We talked about heart and soul. These are unteachable things, aren't they? You either have it or you don't. When one of our listeners might walk into one of your restaurants, they'll notice that in abundance in all your rooms, I think. How do you put that together? Is it something to do with the lighting, the height of the ceiling, the materials you use for curtains so that it's not too loud but just loud enough? Are there shortcuts to making a room have a vibe, I wonder? Taking the lid off his pen and writing down these recommendations.
I think you've mentioned a lot of the elements. Acoustics are an incredibly important part of any restaurant. Loud enough that there's a buzz, not too loud that you can't hear each other. And, of course, it depends what demographic you're aiming at. It's also working with the building is essential. Time and time again, I see people impose a type of restaurant on the wrong environment, and it jars. whenever we've bought restaurants, we walk into them. It goes back when we bought the Woolsey, the first time we saw it, the agent had offered to me, and I said, no, we really want to get hotels. This is early 2003. And he said, just go and have a look. And I walked in, I thought, oh, gosh, and said to Chris, what do you think? And
he
said,
that's an imposing space.
It's an imposing space. And it looked very different at the time because it was called China House. And he said, well, isn't this the Grand Cafe you've always been going on about? I said, yes. And but we both knew innately that it was Viennese coffee house meets European quasi-French brasserie. It was that genre, and hence no backstory. And it's always been that way. I, for instance, remember when we were looking at Fisher's, I'd been keeping an eye on it for a long time. I think Marylebone area is terrific. And it came up and we had to move very quickly. And we now have investors, and so I needed to clear through them the release of the money. I was asked, are we going to do another Colbert? And I said, no, I'm not into rolling out the restaurant. I said, well, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. I haven't spent enough time in the room. And it's standing in the room where it was, the feeling, the ear, etc. Suddenly the idea of it being a restaurant opened by effectively refugees from Vienna. From
this is, again, the sort of fictionalization.
And it's a fictionalization.
Has to happen, yeah.
And this couple emerged. And what was really touching is because before the war, the Jewish immigrants and the Fisher's couple, I always imagined to be him Jewish and her Catholic. If you were poor, you went to the East End. If you were slightly more affluent, you went to Northwest London. And the whole story developed from that. So there's tributes to restaurants in Vienna, like Zum Schwarz und Kamel, and there's all the places. Richard Tauber, the most famous early 20th century tenor, happens to be a large painting, which my wife found in Czechoslovakia, dominating it. And I sat down and wrote the history of going back to what it meant to be in Vienna in 32, 33, the people who were there. There's all those dictators, Freud, the creators, Stefan Zweig and people like that, and how it then transported to London and told the history of how the Fishers came and why their influences. I remember a soft opening. I was asked to go to a table, which was somebody I'd known for 35 years, who was reading this history that the waiter had given. It was a briefing document. And he was crying. What's wrong? He said, but you've just told the story of my grandfather and grandmother who did this exact journey and opened a restaurant on Finchley Road called the Old Vienna. And he said, this is what was happening. And how did you know? I said, I didn't know. I think one of life's most important things is to follow intuition and instinct. And that was the building, that was the environment, that was Marylebone talking to me.
Do any of these places exist? Have you been to places? Are there, people call them benchmarks, don't they, in branding, I think, and in advertising? There is the Grand Colbert in Paris, which is an old brass rail joint. It's slightly overlit and full of palm trees, isn't it? It's quite
yeah, well,
fun.
I think ever since they did, what was the film? Something's Got to Give with Jack Nicholson and Diane Keaton. They've traded on that. They even play it. Le Grand Colbert is, I'm often asked, where did the Colbert get its name from? And Pierre, my fictional character there, I said, well, he'd want to self-aggrandize a bit and think of Le Grand Colbert because he came from Paris. And he'd also think about Colbert, who was Louis XIV's minister. And there was a Comité Colbert, which looked after all things great and French. I said, but deep down, I think he just fancied Claudette Colbert.
Okay. And,
interesting what you say about the Grand Colbert, the one which actually in some ways is most benchmarked is Zadel. And that's...
which is the nicest place to walk down the stairs of in London.
Do love the way that unfolds.
Me and my wife's first date.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
We see again.
See, it worked.
Well,
it's a
catalyst again, you see. Yeah. when an agent said to me, do you want to have the old Atlantic Bar and Grill? And I did the normal, let me think about it, no. I said, oh, come on, go and have a look at it. So I went down not expecting anything. And it was a major development because they were demolishing the old Regent Palace Hotel. And walked in and suddenly again, it was the building. It spoke to me. I was entirely beguiled. And I thought, yeah, we're going to do this, and went back to the fellow directors and so on, including Chris, and said, I want to do the Old Atlantic. And they said, no, it's a basement. You won't get people down there. So on and so forth. And then I said, no, we're going to do Chartier. And Chris understood immediately. And Chartier, or Bouillon Chartier, as it's fully called, is one of the great restaurants of Paris, where working people, artists, even aristocrats would come together in a wonderful grand brasserie, not quite as grand as Adele, share tables, eat incredibly cheaply and quickly. And it was really a response to thinking, I was watching my kids grow up, and they were starting to go out and spend what I thought was a considerable amount of money on not very good restaurants, sometimes chain restaurants. I said, I really want to do something affordable, a treat for the student, a sort of canteen for the more affluent. In fact, we've got a very strong, very wide demographic because a lot of more retired people use it as well because they still enjoy the fine things but can't necessarily afford it.
And you have prefix and all those brasserie standards.
Absolutely. And you see, Chris and I have always believed that restaurants should be egalitarian. I'm a very firm egalitarian. And a lot of the most interesting people who come into restaurants are the least affluent. And therefore, you mustn't exclude them. So our motivation is, if with those people can come through the door, we must give enough people the opportunity to spend, but not make it mandatory, so that there's a complete cross-section of society. I remember Peter Langan always said that what he aspired to in a brasserie was a place where the taxi driver and the Duchess could sit down in at adjoining tables. And that for me is remains a dream. And so
the taxi driver and the Duchess sounds like one of the lesser known parables, doesn't it?
It does.
Or a
it
dirty
does.
Joke.
Well, I was going to say, or a porn film or something. But the and I felt very strongly. So as Adele, you have real gold leaf gilt. I mean, it was extraordinary refurbishment under the Crown Estate. But it was important, even though it was very, very cheap, for want of a better word, doesn't mean to say it has to have paper napkins or anything like that. So we put proper linen on the table, proper principles, and working on on that basis. Took a long time for people to get used to it, and then took a good 2 years. Had to withstand quite a lot of pressure to give up on it. But actually, it's then come storming through. And to go down on a Friday, well, any evening of the week, and say at 9:30 when the cabaret's emptying out, the American bar's full, and the music's just struck up in a brasserie that big, it's exciting.
Well, then you've become the creator you feared you couldn't be when you were 18 years old.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I think that's, well, it's interesting you pick up on that. I mean, the beauty of it is, as time goes on, I realize there's part of me which is a little bit architect, a little bit creator, a little bit writer, a little bit, I don't know, many things manqué, but
a little bit of a ringmaster, maybe.
Well, in some ways. And then I become a catalyst, so it gives me a great deal of enjoyment.
And just finally, people will be very interested in how you put a night together. People want to know how many tables you keep aside just in case Madonna turns up to the Wolseley. How does that work, Jeremy?
Sometimes people get quite outraged by the notion that tables are kept back because they say, well, you can't claw yourself an egalitarian. But of course, people want to go to a restaurant which is A, buzzy and fun, and B, has an interesting group of people. It is fair to say if you have 25 tables, if you take the first 25 bookings, they're probably going to be disappointed. And I know it's the oldest restaurant joke is the customer who says, have you got a table for two? No, I'm afraid not. I bet if Prince of Wales was to walk in, you'd find him a table of two. Well, maybe we would, sir, but, well, he's not coming. I can tell you that with good authority, so can I have his table? It's the old, and people don't understand, but it's not just celebrity we keep tables back for. It's people who are regular customers, because there's nothing worse than building up a relationship with a restaurant and actually being part of its success and then subsequently not being able to get in. But there's a lot more to it in restaurants, and I remember when Adrian Gill, A.A. Gill, wrote about the ivy. He very perceptively understood that what we were trying to do, in his words, was not allow any tribe to dominate. The great restaurants are when you have theatre people sitting next to advertising, to publishing, to film people, to any number, nobody should dominate because it then becomes uncomfortable. So for us, it is, people talk about it, curating a room, it's understanding who the customers are. But again, it's the whole point of the business. And as I say to the staff, if it's only about sitting people down, taking orders, serving, cooking, etc., it's a really boring business. But if you understand how that food's reared or grown and the wine and all the fascinating things about it, and then mixing it with people and who they are and why they can't sit next to each other and so on, it's one of the most fascinating because it is at the root of our culture. If you think about it, virtually every major movement, culturally or revolutionary, has started in a grand cafe, whether it's in Paris or Moscow or wherever it might be. So the art of the restaurateur is perhaps, I'm being slightly evasive in actually how we do it, but I'd never ever pretend that we don't hold back a very large proportion of our tables for the people who've made us successful.
Dictators and creators, right? Exactly. And letting bygones be bygones.
Well, that's true.
A bit of that too. Jeremy King, thank you so much for your time, for taking us by the hand, actually, and whisking us through centuries and through many different rooms, all wafting with good food and good conversation. Thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate it. It was fun.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Robert Bounds, in conversation with Jeremy King. The Big Interview is produced by Bill Luty, researched by Gaia Lutz, and edited by Claire Crofton. Until next time, all that's left to say is goodbye and thanks for tuning in.